was said to have allowed the cakes of a poor woman whose hospitality he'd prevailed upon at his lowest ebb to burn because he was distracted thinking about what to do about the fact that he was sitting in a hovel monitoring peasant bakery when he was supposed to be King of Wessex. I didn't mention it earlier because there is no contemporary corroboration of this story, so it's probably not true. Plus, unlike the Vikings' horns, neither is it particularly fun. It's in a strange category of boring myth and legend that also includes the tale of Hannibal of Carthage's brief attack of conjunctivitis and the time Charlemagne was given advice about dealing with recurrent damp by an apparition of the Virgin Mary. These last two myths get their first citation here. Ethelred and co. didn't have to hide in a marsh. When, in 1013, they got chucked out of the kingdom by Swain Forkbeard, they hung out at the Norman court in Rouen, care of Emma, enjoying the hospitality. Under Emma's influence, Ethelred and the Normans got pretty close, and their son, Edward, future king and saint, stayed there for 25 years. You are what you eat, they say, which must be why some suspected that he was never properly English after that. Ex-kings, future kings and aristocrats who were out of favour in Britain would be sojourning on the continent forever after. The future Edward III, the ex and future Edward IV, the future Henry VII, the future Charles II, the former James II and Bonnie Prince Charlie, all the way down to ex-king Edward VIII, who lived out his days in bitter elegance in Paris. They head off to, usually France, to lick their seldom literal wounds, enjoy the cuisine, and dream out loud about coronation or restoration to anyone who'll listen. If the French, or in this case the Normans, reckon it might further their own interests, there's the possibility of serious military or financial support. If not, there's still croissants and sympathy. And in Bonnie Prince Charlie's case, booze. Ethelred didn't have long to wait for his chance. Swain Forkbeard, who had swiftly conquered England in 1013, greatly helped by how sick of Ethelred the English had become, suddenly died in early 1014. He'd been king for 5 weeks. Taking advantage of a sudden death was a viable career path for much of the olden days. If you're looking for promotion nowadays, hoping your immediate superior will snuff it just isn't enough. It's not very nice, and it's likely to lead to disappointment. You have to get proactive and start sending out CVs. People don't die as much as they used to. That's not quite true. People still die at exactly the same rate as they always have, once per person. It's not how it feels, though, because people used to die younger, on average, and more randomly. It jazzed things up, introduced an element of doubt, like the presence of all those hungry lower league teams in the FA Cup. There are all sorts of times in history when events seem to be going in a certain direction, and you're wondering, will so-and-so manage to do this, or will they fail? You're locked into the plot line. It could go either way, and it's very exciting. Then they die at a really weird point in the story, and we're reminded it's not a story. It's soap opera. In soap operas, people expire mid-storyline all the time because of trouble with agents or scandal in the news. Well, whoever was playing Swain Forkbeard asked for his own Winnebago or got hooked on diet pills or accused of assault and was abruptly written out. Back came Ethelred from Normandy. Swain's army wanted his son Canute to be king, but the leading English noblemen were up for giving Ethelred another go. This seems strange, but Swain's swift death made them suspect that God didn't dislike Ethelred as much as they did. Plus, he'd hired a Danish army to come with him. Fresh move, he usually paid them to go away. So he got to be king again. Just about. He probably wouldn't have lasted long had it not been for the fact that he didn't last long. He died in 1016, by which point Canute had returned and was already doing a solid job of conquering the place again. Ethelred had a son. I don't mean Edward, who was still at this point a child in Normandy, or his little brother Alfred, ditto, but an adult by his first wife, Elfifu, not to be confused with Elfifu. He was called Edmund Ironside, the sobriquet in honour of the valour with which he unsuccessfully resisted Canute. He became king, but was then defeated in battle. Nevertheless, they did a sort of rehash of the Alfred Guthrum deal, but with no religious conversion needed because they were both already Christian. On this occasion, though, the Danes were calling the shots, and Edmund only got Wessex and the title of King of England, while all of Mercia, East Anglia and Northumbria went to Canute. Very soon afterwards, still in 1016, Edmund also suddenly died. This is getting ridiculous. There must have been a new executive producer. Canute took over the whole country and, to cement his leadership, married Queen Dowager Emma of Normandy, a.k.a. Elfiefu, despite the fact that he was already married to a woman called, yep, Elfiefu. Chapter 9. See next you Tuesday. Amid all this levity about the strange name Elfiefu, which must have sounded perfectly normal to people in those days, don't think I'm unaware of the enormous vagina in the room. I'm referring, of course, to Canute's name, which is basically cunt. It's very, very nearly cunt. In fact, he's known, and my teacher at school didn't mention this when talking up Alfred, as Canute the Great. I suppose the thinking was that he's deemed more Danish than English, so Alfred was still the only properly English king called Great. Then again, Canute was King of England, which Alfred never was, so I think he definitely counts, and it's casual anti-Danish racism in the teaching establishment of the early 1980s that means his greatness gets ignored. I digress. I'm getting distracted by analysis of history from the proximity of an exceptionally rude word. As a comedian, that's arguably a lapse of professional duty and would prove bitter and perverse listening to any of the learned academics who attempted to teach me history when I was at university, a time when I was focused pretty much exclusively on writing rude comic sketches and neglecting the historical analysis the local education authority was paying for me to go there and do. Those were the days. Theses have been written, with no doubt more in the pipeline. Rude, pipeline could mean rectum. About why slang references to vaginas are deemed hugely offensive, while slang references to penises are considered less fulsomely impolite. But for me, the presence of a king called Canute in all the history books is the culmination of a long journey made by children, which begins with the discovery of the word poo, continues through noticing the missing I on every toilet sign, they've even left a gap for it, and reaches its greatest joy with the widespread usage of the word bosom in hymn lyrics. The bottom, fart, line is this: I don't want to become someone who will blithely carry on when a king's name is as close to the word cunt as Canute's is. If I get to the point where that amusement is lost on me, the fact that a big, important, serious king is very, very nearly called King Cunt the Great, or the Great Big Cunt, then I think an important part of me will have died. He's often known as Canute. Maybe that version of his name is a hyacinth bouquet-style attempt in later centuries to distance him from genital connotations. You've probably heard the stories of King Canute failing to stop the tide. I've heard it told two ways, one in which the king is foolish for thinking he can stop the tide, and the other in which he's brilliantly showing what vacuously craven yes-men his nobles are for falsely claiming that as king he can stop the tide. I don't know if either is true, but we do know that he couldn't stop the tide. Stupid cunt. It seems Canute was an effective king, despite his inability to influence lunar gravity. It's by accident, not merit, that William the Conqueror gets all the attention. Canute conquered England and ruled it, plus Denmark and Norway. William only had it and comparatively tiny Normandy. Also, Canute was genuinely king of the Anglo-Saxon Kingdom of England. He didn't bring in a brand new Danish aristocracy and loads of Norwegian bishops, though under him the title of the most senior nobles charged with governing large areas of the country changed from Ealdorman to the ironically less foreign-sounding Earl. Otherwise, he largely worked with the people in institutions that were already in place. To my mind, this is both sensible and comparatively nice. Taking all the weird soap opera randomness of history out of the equation for a second, an Anglo-Danish kingdom made lots of sense. For the last five chapters, I've been banging on about the Vikings and the Anglo-Saxons, or the English as they came to be known. Surely this regime is where all that has been heading. Instead, the soap opera of England is going to take a sharp turn away from Scandinavia and towards what is starting to be known as France. At this point, under the empire of Canute the Great, that doesn't feel natural at all. It feels weird, random, and like the producers didn't take the decision for creative reasons, but because the advertisers of Cruises of the Fjords have been dramatically outbid by Bon Maman. And that, I'd say, is a lesson we can learn from history. Possibly the only one. You never completely know what's about to happen. Damnation avoidance. I don't suppose Canute was nice. It's hard to imagine any of these kings being pleasant people. They did so much killing. Some straightforward in-battle killing, which doesn't seem that sunny, but also quite a lot of having people executed, which is even less friendly, and, in many cases, a decent chunk of arranging for people to be murdered, which is downright spiteful. For example, when Swain Forkbeard died in 1014 and the English opted to allow Ethelred back, Canute was holding a lot of English noble hostages that his father had taken when invading the kingdom a few weeks earlier. Canute returned the hostages, but only after he'd had their hands, ears and noses cut off. Can you imagine doing that? I really can't, and I don't count myself a particularly nice person. My faltering GCSE empathy lets me down again here. Were these kings like driven CEOs in an age where murder and mutilation were deemed less serious, or could be justified for religious reasons, or could be atoned for by industrialising the process of getting monks to pray for your soul? That's what chantries were, big, expensive religious buildings which rich people funded so that thousands of monk hours would be put into praying for their souls, thus making sure they evaded hell and sped through purgatory straight to lovely heaven, where they'd presumably then bump into all the other rich nobles they were already accustomed to socialising with. It seems like a weird notion, the religious equivalent of tax avoidance. Those rich guys must have thought that, like with the inland revenue, it was possible to game the system, that omniscient God wouldn't notice that the millions of prayers saying how lovely Duke Charles the Rapist was were all coming from monks living in buildings he paid for. They must have thought God was an idiot, a very powerful idiot. If your experience of government is exclusively medieval kingship, why would you expect the celestial realm to be a meritocracy? Whatever his dearth of niceness, Canute does seem to have been clever. By marrying Emma of Normandy, he neutralised the threat of her and Ethelred's two sons, Edward and Alfred, who were still sojourning in Normandy. By restoring and respecting Anglo-Saxon institutions, he was able to seem more legitimate and gloss over the fact that his only justification for being King of England was conquest. By being a Viking, he very effectively dealt with the Vikings. They were literally no trouble, because they'd won. Letting people win can be a great way of shutting them up. If only it had worked on Nigel Farage. We still haven't got to William the Conqueror, and yet there already seems to be an enormous amount of conquering going on. Swain Forkbeard and Canute, and even poor old Ethelred, who regained some sort of control in between the two. All of these men conquered England, and Vikings had been conquering bits of it, and Anglo-Saxons reconquering them again for centuries. Conquering England doesn't look like that big a deal at this point. In fact, it seems like one of the main things that happened in England since everyone forgot how to build villas. Conqueror is an unremarkable nickname for 11th century England, a bit like setter-up of a website would be in 2001. All the conquering had not left England in tatters. On the contrary, it was a coherent and organised unit, hence Canute's canny decision to govern it through its existing structures. Shires, run by shire reeves, sheriffs, divided into hundreds in most of the kingdom, and wapentakes in the more scandy bits, over which ealdormen, later earls, exercised authority. Taxation was raised according to areas called hides, carucates in Scandy. There was an advanced and regularly reissued coinage system, and written royal commands were routinely distributed to the whole kingdom. This is impressive stuff. It's not like they had email. Hardly anyone could read. In summary, it was a lot less shit than most places at the time. Not much in the way of stone buildings, but it was prosperous and administratively sophisticated. That's why lots of people were keen to nick it. Chapter 10. A Pair of Canutes. There was a brief hiatus in the conquering between 1035, when Canute died, and 1066. Canute's son Harthacnut, Canute, a name which surprisingly means tough knot, not hard cunt, was all set to conquer England in 1040, but didn't have to in the end because the guy he was hoping to conquer it off suddenly dropped dead. This was another son of Canute, not by Emma, but by his first wife, Elfifu, who was called Harald Harefoot. Nickname, not surname. I wonder how Harthacnut felt. Relieved, I suppose. Still, it must have been an anti-climax. All that prep and then you don't have to do anything. Like when exams were cancelled during the pandemic. Empathy attempt. Think of all the wasted adrenaline, the squandered food. Catering for an invasion is a much more important historical role than it gets credit for, as we know from the fact that the expression "an army marches on its stomach" is attributed to generals, not chefs. Usually Napoleon, sometimes Frederick the Great, never Escoffier or Jamie Oliver. What I'm failing to consider, of course, is that Harthacnut Canute's main feeling might have been terrible grief that his half-brother had just died. I'm deliberately failing to consider it, because considering it would be a complete waste of time. This was not a loving family, or not in any sense that we'd understand. If it was love, it was tough love. Very tough. I'm thinking specifically of an occasion where someone was blinded. If that's being cruel to be kind, the resulting kindness is going to have to be amazing. In retrospect, I'm glad you blinded me because I'm struggling to think of anything that would follow that. Because it's given me the edge in my dream profession of being a piano tuner? The blinded person predeceased the invention of the piano by about 650 years, and in fact didn't last long after the blinding. I suspect it may not have been done that hygienically. We don't seem to deliberately blind people so much these days, which is good, except for the fact that we now have the know-how to do it much more safely. The royals of the 11th century would look in awe at the efficiency and cleanliness with which leaders of the modern age would theoretically be able to blind their relatives and find it hard to believe how seldom they take advantage of that facility. The blinded man was a half-brother of Harthacnut, but just a step-brother of Harold Harefoot, who ordered the blinding. But I don't think we should infer that Harefoot would balk at blinding a half-brother, or a full-brother, or anyone at all except possibly himself. You're either up for things like blinding people or you're not, and an alarmingly large number of the political leaders of the Middle Ages fall into the former category, which puts the whole "they all went to Eton" issue we have with politicians these days into quite a relaxing perspective. The blindee was in fact Alfred, son of Emma of Normandy and Ethelred the Unready, and younger brother of Edward the Confessor, future king and saint and all-round jammy sod, who came to England at the same time as Alfred, but slipped back to Normandy and was happily munching camembert by the time Alfred was having his eyes put out. I don't like Edward the Confessor. The Agonies of Choice. This all happened as a result of the confused situation after the death of Canute. Another bloody succession crisis. At this point in English history, the rules about who should succeed when a king died were a fair bit vaguer than they subsequently became. If you were hoping to become king, being son of the previous king certainly boosted your cause, but it didn't clinch the deal. Neither did being the eldest son. Other things helped, like being accepted by the major nobles. When brought together to discuss such things, they were known as the Witan. Just imagine the House of Lords, but not so modern. Or claiming with some plausibility to have been nominated by the previous king, or having recently conquered the country by force of arms. On the face of it, this seems like a better system than raw primogeniture, because there's a small measure of merit in the mix. Alfred the Great became king after all his elder brothers, but in preference to their sons, and that seemed like a sensible decision. He was an adult, for a start, and quite clever and determined, while they were bereaved children. The fun thing for us about primogeniture is that the person who ends up as king can be hilariously unsuitable. The way the poor Spanish Habsburgs meandered towards extinction after centuries of dogged adherence to agnatic, male-only primogeniture and intermarriage led to some entertaining, dribbling and crazily chinned figures, dutifully trying to find a way to impregnate various cousins and nieces, all of whom were equally riddled with underlying conditions, using whatever enfeebled genitalia their lopsided genetic inheritance had bequeathed them. It's less fun for the people living at the time. And is fun the main thing you want from a governmental system? Storing up anecdotes for posterity makes sense for a character actor and raconteur, but it's not a sound basis for building a regime. With that in mind, the 11th century English convention of being able to choose a king, even from a small shortlist largely of members of the same family, seems helpful. It would have allowed the 17th century Spanish to benefit from rulers who could feed themselves unaided. But there is a massive downside: uncertainty. When a king dies, you really want everyone immediately to know and accept who is going to be the new king. Civil war can do a lot more damage to the state and its inhabitants than the most befuddled inbred. A fair bit of uncertainty is okay in states with a more stable governmental structure, where the various candidates for power don't have their own armies and there's an effective civil service and law enforcement system to keep things ticking over while the future leadership is decided. That's what happens in functional democracies. It's a prerequisite if you want to enjoy the luxury of choice without enduring the unluxury of constant violence. In comparatively unsophisticated medieval states, periods of murderous uncertainty, such as that after the death of Knut and many, many other occasions, before, since and elsewhere, made people look increasingly favourably on primogeniture. At least then you know. Not always. Kings can die without sons, and daughters absolutely weren't seen as satisfactory alternatives. Then you're into a whole rival claimant's nightmare. But a lot of the time, it meant that at least everyone knew which idiot was coming next. If your expectations of the state are low, that can be a comfort. There's not much to be said for a choice of idiots, even when civil war isn't a realistic threat, as the recent politics of the UK has demonstrated. A fiddly bit. The two candidates for king at Canute's death were Harthacnut, Canute, his son by Emma of Normandy, and Harold Harefoot, one of his sons by Elfyifu. Harold was right there on the scene, all ready to be king, with Elfyifu on hand to promote his cause. In fact, some say he got his nickname, which means swift like a hare, from the speediness with which he put himself in front of the assembled Witan to claim the throne. If so, it seems a snide compliment, a bit like calling him king first of the buffet. Meanwhile, Harthacnut was busy securing his father's other kingdom of Denmark, though his claim to the English throne was still being energetically advanced by Emma and the most powerful lord at the time, Earl Godwin. Godwin was an Anglo-Saxon, but a massive Danophile. He'd hit the big time under Knut, and thereafter worked tirelessly to end up on the right side of things in order to remain a major player. Was he a kingmaker, or did he just back whoever looked like winning anyway? This question is often posed about Rupert Murdoch. Was it the Sun what won it for Tony Blair in 1997? Or did Murdoch and the Sun swap sides to back Blair when his victory started to seem inevitable? Same question for Fox News and Trump in 2016. Godwin was very pro-Emma and Harthacnut in 1035, but that all went a bit phone-hacking for him because the Witan gave the throne to Harold with a napkin round his neck. Or they sort of did. It was a bit unclear, which must have been very annoying for the overwhelming majority of people who didn't give a shit who was king but wanted it decided. Harold was effectively king of most of England, though not crowned because the Archbishop of Canterbury was not a fan and point-blank refused to, while Emma of Normandy and Earl Godwin were vaguely in charge of Wessex on behalf of Harthacnut. This unstable situation put the willies up Godwin, who reckoned he'd backed the wrong horse. That's when Alfred turned up. Remember him? The one who gets blinded. Harefoot's stepbrother and Emma's son by her first husband, Ethelred the Unready. It's not clear why Alfred came to England then. Emma later claimed Harold forged a letter from her to lure him, but it's more likely she genuinely invited him, hoping it would boost her position, but then regretted it because it didn't and he got blinded. What with Harthacnut stubbornly staying in Denmark, she may have fancied her chances of restoring the House of Wessex. She was an energetic woman. Whatever the reason for Alfred's arrival, Godwin welcomed him as an honoured guest and then, in order to curry favour with the new regime, immediately turned him over to Harefoot, who had him blinded on the way to Ely, where he died without even having seen the magnificent cathedral for the combined reasons that he was now blind and it hadn't yet been built. By 1037, Emma had fled to Bruges. Harold Harefoot's position was stable with the newfound support of Godwin, and Edward the Confessor, who had travelled to England at the same time as Alfred, but separately, and was able to leg it without being mutilated, was back in Normandy, probably praying or looking wise or going to Calvados tastings, waiting for the Kingdom of England to be served up to him on a fucking silver platter, which, infuriatingly, was just about to happen. Harthacnut hadn't given up on ruling a second kingdom, and once he'd sorted out Denmark, started planning the invasion I mentioned, the one that turned out not to be necessary thanks to Harefoot's narratively insensitive death. Harthacnut then arrived in England, having collected his mother from Bruges, became king, and had Harefoot dug up, beheaded, and thrown into a fen, just to work off some of that unspent invasion energy. Plus, I suppose, to avenge the blinding and death of his half-brother Alfred. So there was love in that family, but it tended to manifest itself in violent acts of vengeance rather than birthday cards. Harthacnut swiftly made himself very unpopular, partly by raising taxes to cover the costs of all the ships he'd organised for the invasion. To shore up his position, he invited his other half-brother, Edward, over from Normandy, and far from blinding him, proclaimed him his co-king and heir before dying without issue after getting shit-faced at a wedding. It's possible he was poisoned. So Edward the Butterside Up became king. I expect he thought he deserved it. Chapter 11. King Edward the Confessor. The Danish historical cul-de-sac in English history ends here. Or nearly. The days of Scandinavian kings and dragon ships thick with metaphorical helmet horns breasting the horizon are almost over. It's 1042 and the House of Wessex is back in charge as if it had never happened, as if it had all been a weird 250-year-long nightmare. Not quite. Edward the Confessor, while on paper a straightforward Anglo-Saxon king, and indeed a great-great-great-grandson of Alfred the Great, if you can imagine anything so posh, was in reality a bit different. He'd gone slightly Norman. Because of the Danes, he'd been living in Normandy for most of his life, and his mother, his key advocate, was Norman, while his father, Ethelred, the previous proper Anglo-Saxon king of England, was long dead. The English regime was already turning continental under Edward, even before William turned up. Despite this disconcerting whiff of garlic, Earl Godwin noticed which way the wind was blowing this time. Maybe the garlic made the wind more noticeable, or caused the wind. Are you enjoying how I'm mixing tired meteorological metaphor with anachronistic xenophobic slur with fart joke? I have no idea whether any more or less garlic was used in the cookery of 11th century Normandy than that of 11th century England. I reckon I can get away with the mild xenophobia because of modern France's GDP. In my experience, people don't tend to object anywhere near as much if you're rude about affluent nationalities. The problem I now face is thinking of the equivalent thing that Danish people stereotypically smell of, which, come to think of it, might be a branding issue the Danish tourist board need to look at. Come on, guys, what's your when in Rome? When in Copenhagen you eat bacon? Lerpak? Rancid tinned fish? No, I think that's a Swedish thing. Perhaps you have a glass of... I'm desperately trying not to say Carlsberg. Whatever it is, that's what Godwin would pong of if Edward smelt of garlic. These two Anglo-Saxons would pick very different places for their holidays. Godwin was Knut's man and looked to Scandinavia just as much as Edward favoured Normandy. Nevertheless, Godwin energetically supported Edward at the start of his reign, and Edward pretended not to mind that Godwin had betrayed his brother to Harold Harefoot. But he did mind, deep down, which I suppose, given the brutality of the age, reflects well on him. Edward versus Godwin's team. Pick a side. While I'm grudgingly acknowledging positive aspects of Edward the Confessor, I should say that in general his reign seems to have been competent and peaceful. He doesn't appear to suffer from the standard monarchical vices. There's no sign that he was a boozer or overeater or womaniser. He didn't even have sex with his wife. Or much of a murderer. He still liked hunting, of course. It's remarkable how many kings over the centuries were obsessed with hunting. It's like American presidents with golf. It must have been weirdly addictive, like space invaders crossed with smoking. Loads of otherwise very different-seeming kings, Edward the Confessor and Henry VIII and Charles I and Louis XVI and Franz Joseph and George V, were chasing around after wild animals every moment they could spare. Massive sections of the countryside were reserved for them to do it in a way that makes the madness of an emerald green golf course in the Nevada desert seem restrained. Edward did even more hunting than he did praying, and he did an enormous amount of praying, and had Westminster Abbey built in the Romanesque style, beloved of the Normans, for him to pray in. That's not the abbey which is there now, which was completed in the 14th century. Friend though Edward was to the Normans, they do him no favours with posterity. They reduce him to the indrawn breath before the inflation of their glorious balloon. Nothing he did seems to matter, except insofar as it was a precursor to the conquest. What he mainly seemed to do was bicker with Earl Godwin and tip people the wink that they could be the next king. Those two activities are interconnected because the man who actually ended up being the next king was Earl Godwin's son Harold, often called Harold Godwinson for reasons you can probably grasp. The Anglo-Saxons didn't have surnames in the sense we now understand them, but Harold being referred to by that patronymic suggests they're scratching around for some sort of system for distinguishing between the various Ethels, but haven't quite got there yet. Godwinson feels like a short-term solution because it raises so many questions about what Harold's own son might then be called. Godwin-son-son? And then his son? Godwin-son-son-son? That would make it easy to keep track of the generations, but it's going to be a drain on Charter Writers' ink if the dynasty goes on too long. Haraldson? Makes sense, but that's not really a family name, because it's going to change as often as the first names. So stick with Godwinson. Forever. But hang on, why does Godwin get to stick his brand on all his descendants? His father was called Wolfnoth. Why not Wolfnothson? We can only presume an Anglo-Saxon would have absolutely no trouble enunciating that, and it might have the happy side effect of partially draining a dentigerous cyst. The Godwinsons and the Godwinson father, a.k.a. the Harold father or Wolfnothson, were in a very powerful position throughout Edward's reign, and between them held more land than the king. This would have been slightly humiliating for a king under circumstances where this dominant family hadn't previously caused the mutilation and death of his brother. But they had, so it was very humiliating, and it soon got even humiliatinger when Edward was forced to marry one of them. In 1045, Edward married Godwin's daughter and Harold's sister, Edith. It's unlikely to have been a love match. That was the reality of royal marriages for centuries. In this case, it's also unlikely to have been a no-hate match, and that was something that even medieval princes and princesses were permitted to shoot for. OK, maybe you're only 12 and they're 62 and you don't speak the same language and you've never met and yet somehow you're also cousins, but you can still be civil, right? You can be like cordial neighbours who say good morning and occasionally try to procreate heirs. It's weird, but it doesn't have to be horrible. Margaret Teresa of Spain, a 17th century princess whose strange fate it was to marry her own uncle, Holy Roman Emperor Leopold I, affectionately called him uncle throughout their marriage. On top of all these stresses, Edward was very keen to bring some of his Norman chums over and put them into positions of power to try to counterbalance the power of the Godwins, that's what I'm calling them from now on, and to make things feel a bit more like Normandy. He must have missed it. The Godwins weren't at all keen on this. This tetchy situation came to a head in 1051 when the monks of Canterbury put forward one of Earl Godwin's relatives to become archbishop. Edward wasn't having it and appointed one of his favourite Normans, Robert of Jumièges, instead. In the same year, Eustace II of Boulogne, a big shot from northern France who had married Edward's sister and later fought with William at the Battle of Hastings, so very much on the Norman side of things, visited England and he and his men triggered some sort of presumably horrendously violent fracas in Dover, causing the locals to kill about 20 of Eustace's men. Dover was in one of Godwin's earldoms, so Edward took the opportunity to make something of it. He ordered Godwin to punish the townspeople for their treatment of Eustace and co, and when Godwin refused, the king turned on him. Archbishop Robert accused Godwin of plotting to kill Edward just as he had his brother Alfred. I don't know if Robert's pitch was that Godwin was a sort of brother-killing completist, or just that he was generally murdery, so why not the king too? But the reasoning didn't seem to get much immediate scrutiny, and suddenly the Godwins were in very hot water. All the other major Anglo-Saxon earls sided with the king, Edward put Edith in a nunnery, and the rest of the Godwins legged it. Who are you rooting for at this point? I've made my feelings pretty clear, I know. Even though Earl Godwin seems a bit of a rotter, there's something about Edward that comes down the centuries as insufferable. He's such a virtue signaller. I can totally imagine him on social media, taking pictures of himself praying or saying tasteful things about the architectural style of his new minster. This is projection on my part, but I'm not a professional historian, so I don't have to pretend I haven't picked a side. In fact, I'd argue that historians telling themselves they haven't picked a side are more misleading in an insidious way, because they definitely will have done, even if they don't know it. People can't help it. We do it without thinking. I have a favourite eye. Of my own eyes, that is. I prefer the left. I'm just fonder of it. I wear contact lenses and I put the right lens in first with a sort of clinical coolness, and then I do the left and it's more friendly. To me, my left eye feels like the underdog, but I'm on its side, metaphorically. Literally, it's on my side. My right side, as you look at me. The sides we're dealing with here are going to morph into the sides at the Battle of Hastings, when Edward's beloved Normans, led by his great-nephew William, take on Harold Godwinson. Perhaps that's the fundamental reason I don't like Edward. It's because I can't help cheering for Harold when I think about the Battle of Hastings. Who wants to be king? The Godwins were soon back and even more powerful than before. They'd scattered to Ireland and Flanders, but in 1052 they returned and raised an army of their supporters in the southeast. Strangely, there wasn't a fight. This time it was the king's support that melted away, and the Godwins were restored to all of their roles, including Queen of England. That must have been an awkward homecoming, returning to a man who'd banished her to a nunnery 6 years into a marriage that he'd already refused to consummate. Hard to take that as a compliment. I like to think she coped by employing withering sarcasm. Edward had to send his Normans home, including Robert of Jumièges, who was replaced as Archbishop of Canterbury by an Anglo-Saxon prelate called Stigand. Genuinely, that's what everyone says he was called. To me it sounds like a name someone has hastily invented while trying to conceal extreme drunkenness from a police officer. The last D in particular reeks of falsehood and lager burp. The king's attempt to assert control had failed. This is the point when the bickering with the Godwin section of Edward's reign gave way to the suggesting to lots of people that they can be king phase. Annoying though this must have been for many people at the time, it makes sense psychologically. There Edward was, totally under the Godwin's various thumbs, largely powerless. All he had left were the undisputed facts that he was king and that he didn't have any children. The throne was seemingly in his gift. Frankly, he might have started promising people they could be king just to get some attention, as an excuse for a chat. He wasn't going to be dealing with the fallout. The precise details of whom Edward offered the throne to and when are lost. It's slightly a mists of time thing, but there are some extra mists that have been pumped in by the Norman dynasty, who wanted to appear as legitimate as possible to posterity. Once again, history is written and edited by the victors. Or rather by some nerds the victors have ordered to write it, the actual victors being far too macho and illiterate to be asked to write it themselves. It seems likely Edward genuinely did offer the throne to Duke William of Normandy in 1051, during the Godwin's period of exile. In fact, one of the Earl's sons and one of his grandsons appear to have been given to William as hostages. I suppose the idea was that Godwin would then support the Duke's claim. But it didn't work, and anyway, Godwin died in 1053. Next, in 1056, Edward tipped the wink to his half-nephew, Edward the Exile, by inviting him back to England from Hungary, whence he'd been spirited off as an infant to stop Cnut having him murdered. This Edward would have been the official heir by the rules of succession that developed later, the ones we're now familiar with. He was the son of Edmund Ironside and the grandson of Ethelred. But he died soon after getting home, leaving a 5-year-old son, Edgar, always referred to as Atheling. That's the Anglo-Saxon word basically meaning royal prince who's certainly a candidate for next king, but isn't anything as reassuring as a confirmed heir. The fact that this status was sufficiently common to justify its own word is a key reason there was so much fighting. The other major contender was Harold Godwinson, Earl of Wessex and the most powerful man in England since the death of his father. Edward allegedly left the throne to Harold on his deathbed in January 1066. The chief alleger of this development was Harold himself, but it seems likely that Edward did say he could take over, if only because the subsequent Norman chronicles, whose primary raison d'etre was to make Harold look like a faithless dick, didn't directly dispute it. Their argument was that William had the prior claim and that Harold had visited Normandy in 1064 and sworn an oath to support that claim. It was the oath-breaking and the consequent displeasure of God that led to Harold's defeat and the general rightness of William's seizure of power. That was their point. We can't know for sure what promises Harold made to William, if any. He probably did visit Normandy, possibly in an attempt to broker the release of the Godwin hostages the Duke was still keeping, but we can't know the circumstances under which any oaths were sworn. There's likely to have been a bit of dodgy pressure involved, in which case a modern lawyer would call the contract illegal and thus non-binding. We can be more certain that when Edward was dying, there were a fair few people hanging around the bedside to witness Harold's being named as successor, and more of them would probably have asserted that it hadn't happened if it hadn't happened. To be honest, Edward sort of had to offer the crown to Harold by that point. Harold was the most powerful nobleman already running the kingdom. Edward was lying in bed, drifting in and out of consciousness. It would have been inconvenient of him not to suggest Harold take over on a more official basis, and might have interrupted the flow of sympathy and cooling head flannels from the surrounding Godwinite magnates, and the warming foot massage he was getting from the Godwinite queen. With his bunions at the mercy of her thumbs, it was no time to mention the Duke of Normandy. Instead, on the 5th of January 1066, he died. Harold knew there were other contenders who might cause him trouble. He got the Witan to rubber stamp Edward's bequest immediately and had himself crowned the very next day. The ceremony was a sort of extra session stuck on the end of Edward's funeral mass. The corpse wouldn't have been cold. It must have been tricky to strike the right tone that the drinks do afterwards. Chapter 12. King Harold of... A friend once told me a true story about a swimming gala at her school. All the children who were watching the gala had agreed in advance among themselves that at a certain moment, let's say when a whistle was blown to start the first race or something like that, all of the watching pupils, dressed in their uniforms though they were, would simultaneously go, "Ah!" run towards the pool and jump in. Much anticipatory amusement was derived from this exciting and ambitious conspiracy. But when the moment came and the whistle was blown, one solitary girl, all on her own, suddenly went, "Ah!" ran towards the pool and jumped in. She looked like a maniac. Few of the onlooking teachers will have had the perspicacity to think, "There goes that child's faith in humanity." People don't always do what they say they're going to do. You've got to keep your eye on that and seriously consider not doing what you've said you're going to do yourself in preemptive response. Don't be the first to jump in the pool or the last. These are important things to remember if you're a medieval baron, particularly if the king's just died and you're not a huge fan of civil wars. Everyone's got to watch each other. That's what must have happened at Westminster in January 1066 after Edward the Confessor died. A lot of the leading nobles were around at the time for Christmas and the consecration of Edward's beloved new Westminster Abbey a week earlier, an event the old king was too ill for, which would make me feel sorry for him if I was of a more charitable disposition. The nobles will have watched each other. Harold, the most powerful among them, will have watched too. Everyone will have been a bit worried, most just wanting a nice, stable government to come out of this. They certainly weren't all thinking, "This is my chance to be king." Perhaps only Harold was. And he was right. Harold's other big worry. Harold's reign started smoothly. Nobody jumped in the pool. There was a nice consensus about the next king, which is remarkable considering that there were several claimants and the successful one wasn't at all royal. Yet he knew that there was trouble ahead, likely to come from one of two people. William, obviously. Harold knew the Duke would respond in some way. And Tostig Godwinson, Harold's errant younger brother. In general, the Godwins stuck together. It was a key strength in that family. King Edward was the richest person in England throughout his reign. He held the most land. It was only collectively that the Godwins had more. Staying united was crucial to their rise. England at this time was divided into earldoms. Earl wasn't just an aristocratic title. It meant you pretty much ruled a bit of the country. By the early 1060s, Harold and his three brothers held all the earldoms except Mercia. Harold himself was Earl of Wessex, like his father before him, and Tostig was Earl of Northumbria. Very nice. Then Tostig screwed it up. Northumbria, which had been a major Anglo-Saxon kingdom, and then a major Viking one, was different from the southern earldoms where Tostig had grown up. He was a bit heavy-handed and raised taxes too much and had a few of the wrong people killed, and in October 1065 the Northumbrians rebelled. They chucked him out of York and killed all his officials, and then, and this is the really embarrassing part, they called for the brother of the Earl of Mercia to be their new earl. They asked to change service provider. Whoever does that? It's such a hassle. You start your life with Vodafone and British Gas and HSBC and you're stuck with it unless you're a pervert who gets off on filling in forms. I can't imagine it was any easier to switch from a Godwin Earl, not with their market penetration. They were the earls everywhere except Mercia, remember, and the rebellious Northumbrians asked for Morcar, the younger brother of Edwin, Earl of Mercia. That doesn't sound like a coincidence. It sounds like a snub. The situation got more embarrassing for Tostig. Harold backed them up. He supported the rebels and persuaded the worn-out King Edward to sack Tostig and make Morcar Earl. Around the same time, it should be noted, Harold married Edwin and Morcar's sister. Tostig understandably thought this all stank to high heaven. He refused to accept his deposition, went into exile, and spent most of 1066 buzzing angrily around England's borders, trying to screw things up for his newly royal sibling. Harold, as he took the throne, seemed very secure within England. Now absolutely all the earls were either his brothers or his brothers-in-law, and his treatment of Tostig the previous year probably looked even-handed and kingly to most nobles. But he had made a vicious new enemy in his brother. Naughty Harold wanted to be king. Did Harold Godwinson deserve to lose? The Norman version of history, which William and his heirs energetically advanced after the conquest, claimed he did. But not in the way we might imagine. They didn't say it was lack of hard work or of martial and regal acumen that meant he merited failure. That would have been hard to argue if they'd tried. He was a capable, canny and ruthless operator. For the Normans, what clinched their case against Harold was his lack of luck. That proved he didn't deserve to win, because it showed that God was against him. The reason God was against him, they said, was that he'd broken his oath to support William. He'd committed the sin of perjury, and there was no way lovely old God would allow such a rotter to continue in a position of power. This was drawing a veil over the large number of absolute scumbags who were merrily in charge of vast swathes of the world then and before. In a time of deep and sincere religiosity and terrifying short and brutal human existences, the idea that the hand of God was moving in a mysterious way to ensure some sort of cosmic justice, so that when things seemed to go unexpectedly well or badly, that wasn't just the terrifying random nature of existence, but a tiny, incomprehensible part of some vaguely beneficent plan, was key to keeping everyone's peckers up. Despite all of the above, I'm definitely on Harold's side. I can't help it. He's the ultimate underdog, so I always find myself rooting for him, as if next time I think through the events, he might beat William and stay king. Futile, you might say, but millions of people support football clubs other than the four or five that ever win anything. They root week after week for unsuccessful teams with no more or less statistical hope of major silverware than Harold has of being the victor at the Battle of Hastings when you next check Wikipedia. Plus, as a not very religious person from the 21st century, I won't buy into all the judgmental priggishness about oaths. Harold might have broken his word. So what? It was probably extorted under pain of death or mutilation, either for him or his brother or nephew, whom William had been holding hostage for over a decade. The contenders for power in this era are depressingly willing to be vicious sadists to achieve their ends. In that context, the significance of Harold's alleged promise to support William is utterly lost on me. Ambition aside, stasis wasn't really possible for Harold. He was an overmighty subject, the most powerful English earl by far. Kings don't like that. Even Edward the Sanctimonious Confessor hadn't, and had attempted to destroy the Godwins 15 years earlier. The failure of that plan created a brief period when it was relatively safe to be such a dominant earl, because the king had lost heart. A new king, say William, wasn't going to have it. In theory, Edgar Atheling, now in his early teens, might have done for a bit. Harold could have popped him on the throne and said to everyone, "Look, this little chap has clearly got the strongest dynastic claim. Any attempt by Duke William of Normandy to deny that is going to sound actively funny, whatever he says I swore. So little Eddie's the king. If you don't like it, you'll answer to me." Harold might have been able to continue as the power behind the throne, now that the throne was an adolescent-sized chair rather than a geriatric's deathbed. But for how long? Edgar would grow up and want real power. William would probably have still invaded. The leading barons might not have thanked Harold. Children on the throne are notorious catalysts for trouble. Hostile forces see it as a great opportunity to start chipping bits off the kingdom. It seems less likely to have worked out than Harold taking the throne himself. For Harold, it's either promotion or demotion, and demotion might have been fatal for him even without a big battle. I'm sure Harold's primary reasons for seizing power were straightforward, ambitious, brutal, egotistical ones, but it's worth bearing in mind that a life of pious and dutiful service to a new king wasn't necessarily an option. It's odd, in light of the whole history is written by the victors thing, that Harold should be such a sympathetic figure in the eyes of posterity. It's not just me. I think most British schoolchildren learning about the Norman conquest root for Harold. When I was about 7, as part of the relentless cutting out and sticking with which primary school teachers fill their charges' days, we all had to pick whether to make little versions of Harold's banner from the Battle of Hastings or William's. Almost everyone opted for Harold's valiant little dragon rather than William's pompous papal cross. William's banner had been personally blessed by Pope Alexander II, who backed the Duke's claim to the throne. More evidence of the Normans' assiduous self-justification campaign. As is, looked at in a certain way, my personal dislike of Edward the Confessor. Bear with me, this is a bit convoluted. My starting point in this bit of history was as a Harold supporter. Before I'd heard of Edward the Confessor, I knew about the Battle of Hastings and who won, and thought that was a pity. I only learnt about Edward afterwards, and didn't like him because he seemed pro-William. The fact that that's how he seemed is the victory of Norman propaganda. Central to William's claim was the assertion that Edward had bequeathed the throne to him. My dislike of Edward shows that I have bought that argument. Well done, the Normans. It doesn't make me think William should have been king, though. Since I'm a 21st century comedian, the issue of royal legitimacy isn't that important to me. Typical TV lefties. I'm imposing anachronistic values. Some would say that's unfair of me. I reckon I've got the right to enjoy 1066 in whatever way I like. More anachronistic values. I support Harold because he's defending his homeland against an invader. What business has William got being King of England? He's practically French. If not French, he's a Viking. What I'm not also thinking is he was born out of wedlock, so shouldn't have anything nice. Mean though that sounds, it would be less anachronistic. Though still slightly anachronistic, as insistence on legitimacy of birth didn't fully kick in till the 12th century. The events of 1066 happen on the tail of a slightly more relaxed attitude to it, possibly thanks to those Viking kings who had more than one wife on the go, e.g. Canute, who was married to Emma of Normandy, and also one of the many Elfyfus, but all of whose king-sired issue might be in the running for next monarch. Still, while the 10th century rules of succession might have been vaguer than they subsequently became, that doesn't mean anyone could apply. You were supposed to have some sort of family claim. Otherwise, there's no limit to who might have a pop, which, as discussed in the last chapter, has shitty consequences unless you've got a massive and stable infrastructure to stop applicants turning the country into a battlefield. Such infrastructures were not available in Western Europe at the time. Some royal blood was expected. Harold had none. William, who was spitting tacks about Harold's swift coronation, had some. Little Edgar Atheling had loads, though the poor kid had little else. Harold's seizure of the throne, as nothing more than a very powerful aristocrat, while it might smack pleasingly of nascent meritocracy to us today, was, by the standards of the time, a far more egregious violation of how things were supposed to work than William's armed invasion. But it shows gumption, and he was defending the country of his birth, so he remained sympathetic despite all the subsequent Norman attempts to slag him off. They should have just said he was a pedo. 1066. A good year for Harold. Things had been tough but satisfying for the new king, like an overdone steak when you really need the iron. The year had started well with his being crowned king, then he'd stabilised his position swiftly and relatively peacefully. He'd repelled Tostig's various raids, raised a large army in the early summer, and divided it into sections stationed all along the south coast, while Harold himself set up his headquarters on the Isle of Wight. It was the height of the campaigning season, and he was ready for William. Annoyingly, William didn't turn up. By early September, Harold's troops had run out of food and he had to let them go home. Still, the year was getting on, the weather was likely to worsen, so there was a decent chance, the king must have thought, that William wasn't going to invade at all. Harold then found out that someone else had. Vikings! That's a blast from the past, isn't it? A bit retro, like that Carry On film that came out in 1992. Also like that carry-on film, this was the absolute last time, and it didn't work. It might have done, though. Tostig had been making powerful new friends. He'd persuaded the King of Norway, another Harald, though often called Harald to avoid confusion, so I'm going with that, to attack England for old time's sake. That will have appealed to Harald, I suspect. He is known to posterity as Hardrada, meaning hard ruler, and he was an old-school Viking and renowned bruiser. About 50 years old, which, given contemporary life expectancy, coupled with his lifestyle, makes him about 260 in our years, he was arguably the greatest warrior of the day. He'd spent much of his life fighting for the Byzantine emperors, exotically enough. These actual proper Roman emperors, none of your nouve Carolingian pretension, had an elite force known as the Varangian Guard, largely made up of battle-hardened Norsemen. After a successful career of banging Greeks' heads together, Harald returned to Scandinavia in 1045, made himself King of Norway, and repeatedly attempted to make himself King of Denmark too. He was running out of things to do. At the bottom of all our to-do lists is the last task, die. By implication, anyway. I suspect actually writing it on a list is a red flag, mental health-wise. Perhaps Harald thought conquering England would be a good way of delaying the inevitable. He couldn't have been more wrong. The news that the greatest Viking of the age, at the head of a fleet of dragon ships, had invaded the north, defeated Earls Edwin and Morcar in battle, and taken York, would have been enough to make King Harold doubt whether he'd ever get the chance to enjoy his long-awaited clash with the Duke of Normandy. Yet the new king's response was impressive. He reassembled his extremely recently disbanded army, which, apart from anything else, must have been very annoying to have to do, and marched north so quickly that he caught Harald and Tostig on the hop. At the Battle of Stamford Bridge, just east of York, the Norwegians didn't even have a chance to put on their chainmail. They were brutally and bloodily defeated. Both Tostig and the previously invincible Harald were killed. That was on the 25th of September. On the 28th, William of Normandy landed with an army at Pevensey Bay in Sussex. That's not tremendously convenient, Harald must have reflected as he wearily marched south, though at least this time it's happened before I disbanded my army. I like to think of him as a glass-half-full kind of guy. Chapter 13. Hastings. Battle is such a peaceful place. I've only been there once, about 20 years ago, but I thought it was delightful. A quiet and pretty Sussex town. I've just had a virtual wander round it on Google Street View and it still looks idyllic. It must have been a lovely sunny day when the dystopian droid car went through stealing everyone's data. I was momentarily disconcerted to see that the tea room where I'd had lunch with my parents and brother around about the turn of the millennium seemed to have been turned into a Costa Coffee. I had another look and concluded that the tea room is actually still there, but a nearby old pub, the 1066, had been turned into the Costa, which still isn't great. They've put a swinging sign with the Costa Coffee logo into the fittings where there used to be a pub sign, which to me is worse than McDonald's taking over Notre Dame and having a big Golden Arches M done in the rose window. Pubs have been more significant in my life than cathedrals. If that's a sad sign of the passing of time, how do you think William the Conqueror would feel? The abbey he founded in battle to say sorry for all the killing necessitated by conquering England was closed down by Henry VIII in 1538. Or dissolved, as they say. Well, it didn't dissolve properly. Henry VIII should have stirred it more. Great lumps of it are still there, standing jaggedly on Senlac Hill, where Harold Godwinson died, possibly as a result of having taken an arrow to the eye, though possibly more boringly than that, some historians have felt constrained to point out. Dear, oh dear, you appear to have accidentally captured someone's imagination. Put it down immediately and return to your research on crop yields. You've probably inferred, if you didn't know already, that a battle happened in battle, or near battle. It was, in fact, the Battle of Hastings, slightly untidily. It didn't happen in Hastings, it happened in battle, or near battle. Quite near Hastings, but much nearer battle than Hastings. Of doesn't get a look in. Time is as crucial as place. You can stand in the same place, and depending on the time, you might find yourself on your own in the mud, run through by a Norman knight, praying for a king's soul, being made redundant by another king, having a nice pint, or buying a nasty coffee. When the Battle of Hastings happened, battle didn't yet exist, so they named the battle after Hastings, which did. Otherwise, it would have been called the Battle of Battle. Except it wouldn't, because if battle had existed before the battle happened, it wouldn't have been called battle. It was named battle after the battle, or rather after the Penitentiary Monastic Foundation that was named after the battle. Colloquially, anyway, officially William dedicated it to St. Martin. Then William's 11 greats grandson, Henry VIII, closed it down, and now English Heritage runs it as 1066 Battle of Hastings, Abbey and Battlefield. I can neither confirm nor deny the existence of an afterlife. Frankly, if I could, it would be on the cover of the book. But if there is one, I wonder how Kings William I and Henry VIII are getting on. That's assuming the afterlife isn't just airy-fairy spirits and feelings and nebulous niceness amid white light, but is something we can get our heads round. Translucent figures chatting on clouds, or sweating in lava-dripping hell caves. It's also assuming that both William and Henry would be in the same section of the afterlife, but that does seem reasonable. They were both ruthless and killed a lot of people, so if that matters, they're surely both in hell. On the other hand, they were both kings and incredibly well connected. If that helps at all, as it very much does in this vale of tears, they'll both be enjoying the ambrosia and harp medleys. An afterlife in which one of them is damned and the other saved would seem to be splitting hairs in terms of when it's okay to have people killed in order to get your own way. It also implies a god more engaged by the details of what the Pope thinks than the most self-confident pontiff would dare to dream. William, even his worst enemy would admit, got on better with popes than Henry VIII did. I rather like the image of William the Conqueror tearing a strip off Henry VIII for closing down Battle Abbey, and all the other abbeys for that matter, or possibly roughing him up, like Michael Caine does to Brian Moseley in Get Carter. Henry VIII seems all broad-beamed and martial, but in reality he was a pampered prince, born to a reigning king. Good at sport and jousting in his youth, but his later life was dominated by relationship troubles and a gammy leg. He wasn't a proper warrior like his Norman ancestor, who was born illegitimate, became Duke of Normandy as a child, somehow managed to hold on to the duchy, and then made himself a king. "You're a big man," the Conqueror would say, "but you're out of shape. With me, it's a full-time job, so behave yourself." Slap. The massive year, 1066, the most famous in English history and the inspiration for a million guessable pins, is dominated by, not mine, is dominated by the brilliance and luck of William of Normandy. He needed both to become King of England. That's a bit disconcerting. It's not how we like to view history or world events. History is dominated by big themes and trends. Capitalism, nationalism, colonialism, industrialization, communism, sexism, racism, Christianity, Islam. Enormous things that rise and fall like tides. That's what affects our lives. That's why the USA has so many nuclear weapons and China manufactures so many objects. That's why we all have mobile phones and there's too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This is all caused by the themes, not by a single human's personal drive and whether their toast falls butter side up. What one clever bloke, William, did with his little life, and how the clash of metal between two groups of heavies in the Sussex countryside one October day panned out, isn't supposed to matter much. If William hadn't been ambitious in the first place, or the fight had gone the other way, we like to think it wouldn't have mattered much, because the trends and themes were happening anyway. Maybe that's true. Maybe England was always going to gravitate towards the French axis and out of the Scandinavian one. Maybe, with or without William, the England of, say, 1166 would have been more or less the same, and by the 21st century, the counterfactual history where William didn't exist or died in infancy is pretty much identical, except maybe we have a different word for pork. We'd probably just call it pig. Maybe the deeds of kings are just the details of how inevitable trends played out. The pattern of individual snowflakes rather than the overall fact that there's snow. But it's not how it feels. It feels like important changes started partly because of what a small number of people decided to try to do, and partly because of blind luck. 1066. A shit year for William. The first three quarters of 1066 were an irritating and static time for the Duke of Normandy. With the news of Harold's coronation, the year did not begin happily. William immediately decided to pursue his claim to the English throne, which, frankly, I wouldn't have done. Would you? He was nearly 40, which, considering contemporary lifespans, must have felt like 60. Plus, he was already a very important duke. To my mind, that's a nice comfy laurel for a lovely rest. History must be full of occasions where someone had a reasonable case for raising an army and invading somewhere and didn't, through either fear or laziness. Those people don't get the credit they deserve for the positive consequences of their indolence. By the same token, William's determination to go for it has to be factored in before dismissing the great men interpretation of history. Actually, not men, it should be people. I'm not happy with great, either. Harold and the Anglo-Saxon aristocracy wouldn't have thought it was great. Is annoying people clearer? Ambitious people? Pushy people? Difficult people? Having decided to follow through on his claim to the English throne, William succeeded in rallying a lot of support. This is both impressive and understandable. William was good at waging war and had secured his duchy with constant and ruthless military action. The news that he was planning an enormous corporate takeover must have looked attractive to investors. By early August, he had a large army and navy ready to go. Weather and wind were against him, so he had to wait. This was harder than it sounds. He had to keep supplying the army with food, drink, and other incentives not to go home, as well as stop them all from dying of dysentery.